The Pat Kenny Show
with Aviva Insurance
on News Talk.
When notorious hitman Robbie Lawler was slain in Belfast, the finger was pointed in many directions. Now, 4 years later, in her new book, crime journalist and author Nicola Tallant has undertaken an extensive study to untangle the web of betrayal, and what a web it is. Nicola is with me now. Good morning and welcome.
Morning, Pat.
We must start, though, with Gerry Hutch.
Well, we can't ignore it, can we?
We can't ignore it, no. He has been arrested in Lanzarote by Spanish police, and simultaneously a search of property in Clontarf in the presence of at least one member of the Spanish police. What's going on?
Yes, so there's an investigation. There's a couple of investigations going on. One here in Ireland and one in Spain. The Spanish one, we're told, is a money laundering investigation. And it's that one that has resulted in these raids and searches of the homes. Spanish police come here sometimes and Irish police go to Spain sometimes when there's something big happening and when they can be photographed largely working together. It's part of Europol's push to show us that everybody's working together now. You know, there's no point in just investigating crime in your own territory.
Yeah.
You know, it's so transglobal that it is up to the law enforcement to work and swap intel.
So we don't know how long they can hold him, because the rules over there tend to be different to the rules.
Yeah, that's interesting, actually, because in Spain, sometimes what they do is it works completely separately, different to our system, but they can put them before the magistrate, and the magistrate, as in the judge, starts investigating what the police have investigated so far. The Kinahans, if you remember, in 2010 under Operation Shovel were brought before the courts, and that lurched on for about 10 years.
Yeah.
While they still, you know, had to sign on and all the rest of this. So, and it came to nothing. So you can be.
And when you're on an island like Lanzarote, you know, exiting that island, even if you're out and have to report into the police station every week or every month or whatever it is, might be hard to escape.
Yeah. I mean, look, we'll wait and see what happens. I mean, you know, he's been questioned, obviously. These searches have happened. Of course, the story came out the week previous that he was considering throwing his hat in for the election.
Was that simply mischief making, or do you think it was a serious attempt to disrupt, for example, Mary Lou McDonald?
I think he seriously was and possibly still is considering it. You know, there was a kind of a word that there had been a sort of campaign team put together, that the headquarters had been, you know, identified as the Corinthians Boxing Club. And he was, you know, hadn't come out to confirm it, but I'd say probably he was testing the waters to see what the reaction was. And the reaction was overwhelmingly pretty good, certainly.
In the constituency?
Yeah, well, certainly from the, you know, look, a kind of a brief look over the social media of our own stuff, it was largely quite supportive, to be honest with you.
Why?
Because he's a really unusual character. Like, he's a criminal for a long time, but he is quite liked. And
obviously a man with a singing voice, because he was filmed, I think, doing karaoke.
Well, he's become like, I mean, you know, there's people taking pictures of him and selfies with him and all sorts of stuff since he was released, found not guilty of the murder of David Byrne, which was a huge moment for him, if you remember, when he walked out of the courts. And even that day, you know, he walks out of the courts and the city, anybody passing by at the time, it was a kind of chaotic, but they were all honking their horns and shouting up Gerry at him and stuff. Like, you don't get that with many criminals. It's a strange one.
And then he had famously a haircut and a beard trim.
Yes, and that became
transformed
news.
Himself.
Yeah, that became news too, you know. But look, he's always known how to work the thing, and you remember his limo years in Dublin when he was driving around with
the stretch
Hummer. So he's somebody with, would you call it a sense of humour or an ability to sort of thwart the state and the authorities. A bit of an anarchist, I suppose.
And the state might have brought different charges against him and might have succeeded, but they decided to go in one direction only in the case of the Regency, and the state lost.
Yeah, and really, I suppose, in her judgment, Justice Tara Burns sort of pointed that out, that there was only one charge she had to consider and that the evidence was not there to convict him of murder. You know, there was also evidence given during that case about the existence of the Hutch organised crime group and it being a sort of a familial grouping with patriarchal sort of leaders.
And there are charges can be brought about gang membership. We know that.
Yeah, directing criminal organisations can be brought. You know, you'd wonder, would the state here go for him again after the fiasco?
Well,
it was,
you know, they didn't lose on those charges that were never brought. So it's still open to them to bring more charges if they think they have the goods and the appropriate. But, you know, you don't think about it, but the state has to maybe think, how much would this cost?
Well, exactly.
What's our chance of success?
You know, I mean, how much did the Regency cost? You know, I'm only back from London, where in the Old Bailey, Thomas Bomber Kavanagh and Liam Byrne were convicted.
And Liam Byrne reported as smiling at the moderation of his sentence because they reckon he could be out by Christmas.
Mightn't be a great idea to behave like that, to be honest with you, before the courts, but, you know, appeals can be taken and stuff. But, you know, they, during the first day of the court, when they were brought in the Old Bailey and the security was enormous, the judge actually said it cost $30,000 a day to bring them from Belmarsh, and that the trial, should it have happened, they were given a bit of credit for that, was going to cost millions.
So they plead guilty to these charges and they got 5 and 6 years respectively. But Byrne will be out in relatively short order, his barrister having promised that he will lead an exemplary life.
And he's a spray painter.
Spray painter.
That's what he does.
Yeah. So. Okay, let's talk then about Web of Betrayal and the man at the heart of it, Robbie Lawler. Tell me about him.
Yeah, so Robbie Lawler was the gangland criminal. He had become sort of a dead man walking by the time he was murdered in Belfast in 2020, in April 2020, at a very interesting time, because it was 4 days after the EncroChat hack went live, when police forces across Europe were listening in and watching what was happening in the criminal underworld. He was, the chief suspect was named in court after his death as the man who murdered and dismembered Cian Mulready Woods. Yeah. He was somebody who kind of came out of an emerging gangland as a very volatile Coolock.
From Coolock, not from Drogheda, where the action was taking place.
No, but his brother-in-law had sort of manoeuvred his way into Drogheda and taken a side on one side of the feud, which brought him into it. He was like a chaotic character from a teenager. He was a hitman. He was capable of killing on a whim and also for money. And he sort of lurched from one feud to another, made a lot of enemies along the way, and really peaked in his violence when his brother-in-law, Richie Carberry, was killed and he came out of jail and sought revenge for that and, you know, kidnapped and did what he did to that teenager, which, like, was extraordinary and it was world news. This was narco-style terrorism in the heart of Dublin.
Now, talk to me about the emergence of the gangs in Drogheda and where the drugs trade came. You wouldn't imagine a big marketplace for drugs in that particular town.
Well, actually, that town grew a lot. Population grew a lot because it became a commuter town, as, you know, Dublin, the price of housing became so offensive for young people. And, you know, it's got a big population up there, actually. So it was, and look, it's cocaine again, you know, people go.
The recreational use of cocaine.
Exactly. And
this is not poor wretches shivering, looking for the next fix of heroin.
These are people who work during the week and party at the weekends and etc. And I think the chief up there, the former chief superintendent, Christy Mangan, has spoken a lot about that, criticised that a lot, people's use, recreational use of cocaine and what it did to that town, because in an interview for the book, he spoke about how he at one point had to consider bringing in the army, which he'd never had to even consider in his entire career, because the rule of law and order was about to break down in that town. And it looked like the gangs were going to take over because they simply didn't have the resources, the policing resources to.
So what were the two factions? You know, where did each one come from and what sort of division of territory did they have?
They were one faction, and a younger grouping within the sort of the older order decided that they wanted to try and go it alone as such.
They wanted the loot.
They wanted the loot, and in came Richie Carberry, and he was a significant character from North Dublin. He sort of stayed in the background but funded them, mentored them, and, you know, probably supplied them with drugs and weapons. Started off with little things, you know, spray painting. Interesting to see how it grew actually from that and how toxic those kinds of criminality can be. you know, attacking one another's homes. Then it sort of turned to attacks on one another's girlfriends on each side. Of course, the two sides, a bit like the Hutch Kinahan feud, they knew everything about one another because they had once worked together. And it was all happening in a very small area where you could just watch who was coming in and going out, and they knew where everybody's, you know, grandparents and everything lived. So, yeah, it went from, you know, it went from this small time crime to big time.
Now, the people who came in, like from Coolock or wherever Robbie Lawler came from, how did they recruit the locals?
In the same way, probably, as Robbie Lawler was originally recruited, you know, in areas where there is marginalisation and where there's young kids who actually see it a career option to go into drug gangs, and they, you know, they want to get rich quick. It's quite easy for them to recruit them, you know. And there has been, I suppose, in the beginning of the book, I talk about, you know, go back a little bit historically into how
the godfathers,
and the young kids looking at them and admiring them, and then, you know, each generation seems to become more and more violent.
And it also shows that when the Gardaí are successful in eliminating one particular operation, another will spring up because the recruits are ready made.
For sure. And, you know, those young people are, you know, going out and they're the ones, I suppose, who are doing the spray painting in the beginning and the firebombs at people's houses and all the rest of it. They're doing that high risk sort of criminality. In the background, you have these bigger bosses sitting back and directing it. It's a little bit almost as well like a chess game. If you look at it, they make strategic moves to take people out to kill probably or be killed, you know. And each murder, each thing that happens within gangland has repercussions down the road.
There'll be tit for tat, of course. How do we get to this point?
Well, I suppose it's all about the money, and it's the money in that. I mean, when you look back historically at it, there was a lot of armed robberies and there was a sort of a finite maybe amount of money to be made out of that. And so you're going to have a smaller grouping sharing the pot of that. But when drugs came in, and particularly cocaine by sort of the 2000s, we also, the economy has something to do with it because, you know, we went from massive unemployment in the 80s to full employment, and people had more money in their pocket. So rich nations like our own are the biggest cocaine takers, you know.
Now, we know from the various drug treatment centres that the amount of cocaine addiction, people suffering from it, has increased very dramatically. But you wonder whether decriminalisation is the only way to take the criminality out of it and do for the gangs, or will they simply find something else?
I suppose there'll always be a black market there, but are we anywhere near decriminalising cocaine?
I don't think so, because
you know, it's a class A drug, and how
but
would
yet,
you do that?
Do you know, when you have so many people breaking the law, whether it's, you know, doing 40 kilometres in a 30 kilometre zone, which is so impractical that people just don't bother obeying the law.
Mm.
If so many people are using cocaine in the way you describe, recreationally at the weekends and so on, when the population, if you like, has embraced this breaking of the law, what is the state to do?
Well, what is the state to do? And also, you know, even if you look at decriminalising or legalising any of this stuff, there'll always be, I mean, the next thing coming is undoubtedly the fentanyl, the stuff being made in the factories, which is cheaper to transport, cheaper to make, stronger. And, you know, something will always take over from a market, you know, going back to prohibition with alcohol. That's the one people always look to. I mean, why did we prohibit alcohol and, you know, all the criminality that emerged from that? But, I mean, when you come to cocaine...
And that criminality then found another home once alcohol is legalised.
Of course, and crime will always be there. We'll always have to live with it, I suppose. What you want to do from a law enforcement point of view is try and minimalise it as much as possible and keep the public safe. And the likes of this feud that occurred in Drogheda, even the likes of Robbie Lawler's murder that morning. I mean, I went up to Belfast that morning, and it was a beautiful summer. Like, it was April, but if you remember the beginning of all those lockdowns, it was so sunny. So everybody was sort of out in their front gardens. There was paddling pools and the kids were playing. I don't think anyone was in school. It was lockdown time. So, and, like, you know, he's shot, you know, in the middle of a neighbourhood where there's people sitting out
there. Now, what brought him to Belfast?
Well, after the murder of Cian Mulready Woods, he sort of was up to Belfast quite a lot. He was sort of collecting drug debts he believed he was owed, and he was mixing with the underworld population up there. That would have been unheard of before. There is no border anymore for the criminals, and they are sort of all working together cross border. But he was quite openly living up there. He was renting an Airbnb and he was going out at night, and he had people visiting him, you know, coming up to visit him. But he was floating around. He was very dangerous at that stage. He was
a danger to other people. He was such a volatile and chaotic character. Mm. Do you think he had a sense of how much danger he was in?
You accumulate
enemies along the way.
Yeah. I mean, look, he must have known, of course, but he didn't seem to care. He lived
no
for
precautions.
The day. Very few precautions. He certainly wasn't a careful character. And he was mixing with a lot of people. You know, the underworld in Ireland, while we talk about it, is quite a small place. There is, they all know one another. They nearly all work together, actually, especially when it comes to the business dealings. So, you know, it's difficult to stay here and to hide. And I think he's just, his time had come. He had become toxic and had accumulated so many enemies. And if he wasn't killed there, he would have been killed elsewhere. And there were a number of plots to kill him before that.
And we know the way the Gardaí got a hold of the situation in Limerick and managed to convict a lot of people, get them off the streets. And the, I don't know, is it calm in Limerick? I mean, I'm sure nature abhors a vacuum, so you will have other people selling drugs for the recreational market and so on. But how are they doing in Drogheda? Have they got a handle on it now?
Yeah, I mean, they have certainly got a handle of it. And usually these feuds will play out over a period of time, usually 18 months, and can result in the murder of up to 20 people, seems to be what it is. But they definitely have a handle on it. I mean, Robbie Lawler's death and other things that occurred with other significant characters in that feud seem to have, you know, it almost as if it implodes itself before the Gardaí get to bring them to court, because, you know, the level of proof we need in ordered society to convict any of these people, it's not a fair playing pitch. Yeah.
It's fair to say, and I've heard it mentioned by some senior Gardaí over the years, these guys cannot expect to see the pension.
No, I mean, look, they usually are either, you know, spend their last days in prison or dead. But I mean, they're the ones we talk about. It's the ones that we don't know about that are operating under the surface. They're probably not murdering people and they're running their empires like a business, a proper business. They're the clever ones, and plenty of them do get to enjoy their final years.
I'll bring you some of the comments now. Rosemary says, I'm looking forward to the brilliant Nicola Tallant. Always interesting. She's my ideal dinner party guest.
Oh, right. Okay.
Talking about murder and mayhem over dinner.
Yeah, and I quite like to be fed, so that's good.
I can't help but wondering if it's a coincidence that Hutch's apparent electoral open door into the Doyle coincides with his arrest in Lanzarote. It might gain impetus if, lo and behold, he's released from house arrest once the date for personally presenting your nomination papers has passed. Mm-hmm. That's from John. Cocaine harm denial is just like climate harm denial. People just don't see how their actions affect other people and their environment negatively. One way to stop young kids going into gangs is for career guidance teachers to put it into career choices and include the full consequences. Okay, you get a job. You'll have trainers and you'll have your goose down jacket you have, but you'll be dead by 25. There's your career. No coincidence that the investigation against Hutch is this week. Is the government running scared? How about a story on the proliferation of phone repair, vape and nail salons around Ireland? Are some of them fronts for drugs money laundering? That's the word on the street.
Well, you know, there is definitely certain industries that have been identified as, you know, laundering funds, and some of those that are mentioned have definitely are in there. You know, the car industry and the beauty industry and those sort of ones definitely are.
Once again, this is basic economics, supply and demand. The reason the country is awash with cocaine is because there's a demand there from the people. We have to legalise, regulate and tax straight away. The war on drugs died with Nancy Reagan, says Ed in West Cork. Mm. Anyway,
yeah.
On that pessimistic note,
it's always cheery with me, isn't it?
Thank you very much for joining us. The book, by the way, is called Web of Betrayal, subtitled Murder in Ireland's Brutal Gangland. And it's just out and it's published by Eiru.
Eiru.
Nicola Tallant, thank you very much.
The Pat Kenny Show
with Aviva Insurance
on News Talk.